is Lee Habib, and this is Our American Stories. And this day in history, we're celebrating a life that you don't know. We like to bring lives that you don't know, but you should know. And this one is brought to you, as always, by the great folks at Hillsdale College.
At least until I die. Damn if you do, damn if you don't. I'm supposed to get a raise next week, you know damn well I won't. Working for a living, work. Working for a living, work. Working for a living, living and a working. I'm taking what they're giving, cause I'm working for a living.
History teaches that exceptional people make a difference. Those are the profound words of a father to his son. And they came with the admonition to study history at school. Because, well, you can always learn accounting on the side, he told him. Those words were spoken by Shelby Cullum Davis. A man with roots in Peoria, Illinois. The heart of the Midwest. The heart of America. As his friend, Heritage Foundation founder and fellow Midwesterner, Ed Fulner, shared with us.
It's real America, and it's not liberal, it's not conservative, but it reminds us all, I think, of the roots that we should be sharing and that we should be passing on to future generations, that this is what America is really all about. And boy, Shelby Cullum Davis really represented that.
And had roots that traced back to the roots of America herself.
Ancestors who came over on the Mayflower on his father's side. He knew what American history was about. He knew what the founding was about, and he knew why that was important to succeeding generations. And he made no bones about his preference for the American system.
And like his ancestors, Shelby had a keen sense of adventure. When at the age of 38, and with a wife and two children, he would go on the greatest adventure of his life. The greatest adventure of many Americans' lives. Starting a business. Empowered by his daring but trusting wife, with a $50,000 investment, Shelby opened an investment office, even though he didn't have an MBA. Heck, he didn't have any formal investment training. But he would prudently spend her money. He figured it had to count for something. And it ended up counting for a lot. It was said that Shelby would do all his writing, note-taking, and math on the backs of envelopes he received in the mail, as to not spend money on paper. He'd rather invest it. A product of the Great Depression, he also set out to be prudent with how much risk he took on. So he didn't invest in exotic things. He invested in what he knew. And what Shelby knew was insurance. From it, he'd come to know wealth. A true value investor, when Shelby invested in insurance stocks, he went long on them, and they went long for him, generating an average compounded rate of return of over 23% a year. And after 47 years, their $50,000 turned into $900 million.
He was very much a penny pincher. I remember one time we had had a board meeting in Denver. We got on the plane, Frank Shakespeare and I, we got on and we went to the back of the airplane. And we didn't know that Shelby was also on the same flight. And Shelby got on and he was in seat 27. And he saw us, he said, "Well, fellas, I'm glad you're back here with us real people." It was that kind of thing where he wouldn't spend the extra $100 to ride up front for 3 hours of pleasure, because he believed very strongly that the great compounding machine, as he called it, of Wall Street could use that $100 to make it into $110 next year or $150 in 3 or 4 years. And that's how he made his money.
Money that he made sure his children didn't come to know too well. making clear to them that they would benefit little from it. The world would, and we would. Our dreams would.
His appreciation of the whole story of America and how that story of America was really made up of important individuals came through in everything he did and everything that he stood for. And when he found out about Heritage and he found out that there was this new and exciting institution that could actually help promote the free enterprise system that had enabled him to do so well, enabled so many other people to do so well, and that could fight back against the encroaching big government of the 1970s, 80s, and 90s, he wanted to be on board.
And for Shelby, when he was on board for an adventure, whether it be in Russia, or his business, or with the Heritage Foundation, he was all in on that adventure. It would shape everything else around him, even the seemingly little things.
I remember calling on him one time at his office on Wall Street, and first of all, he said, come into my office just for a minute. I went into his office, which was very, very Spartan, and I looked up at the window, and there were newspapers taped across the window to keep the afternoon sun out, at which point I'm looking up at the newspapers there. He reached into his desk, pulled out an envelope with my name on it, and he said, "That's okay, you can open it." So I opened it, and it was a check for $1 million payable to the Heritage Foundation. So here was a man who knew what he believed in, who wanted to support very substantially what he believed in, but was darned if he was going to spend anything on any frills or anything that he considered unnecessary.
Shelby Cullum Davis.
This is Lee Habib, and this is Our American Stories. And again, this day in history, as always, brought to us by the great folks at Hillsdale College. Go to hillsdale.edu to get their terrific online courses. More American Stories after these messages.
An atomic pepper, Mr. Manolino?
Nah. You guys go ahead.
I'll do it if you will, Lloyd.
Okay. You go first.
No, no. You go first.
No, you go first.
No, you go first.
No, you go first.
I always go first.
Oh, yeah.
Why
do we never go?
You guys
go at the same time, huh?
That sounds like a dare, Harry.
It's a double dare.
Yeah, okay. You're on.
It's not so bad.
It's more tingly than hot.
Yeah.
This is Lee Habib. And Jesse, what were we listening to there in that sequence?
That was the famous scene from Dumb and Dumber where the guys are eating hot peppers
and proceed to make
a mess of the restaurant.
And by the way, the reason we have Jesse as our hot shot on the board and doing so many other things is, well, we're doing the burning question, and this week's burning question from the Wall Street Journal's Heidi Mitchell is, does spicy food cause bad dreams? And Jesse managed to have a spicy food clip and a dream song simultaneously. He deserves a bonus, and Heidi, don't you think he deserves a bonus for that segue?
Oh, definitely. Add a zero to his paycheck.
Add a zero. Hey, pipe down over there, Heidi. Who asked you? Oh, that's right. I did. Well, we're talking to the aforementioned Heidi Mitchell, who does write the Burning Question column each week for the Wall Street Journal. And by the way, on this show together, we have wrestled some of the big burning questions like, why can't you tickle yourself? And more importantly, when dogs lick you, is it going to make you sick? And by the way, we solve those problems. And if you want to hear the answers, go to OurAmericanNetwork.org. And listen, or just Google those things or Heidi's name with the Wall Street Journal in there and put dog and tickle and you're off to the races. And Heidi, thanks for joining us again.
Thank you for having me again.
Well, let's start before we get to the spicy food, which, by the way, I think we could do an hour on spicy foods and just get people's opinions, because people have hard opinions about spicy foods. But I wanted to start with dreams. And you wrote that dreams have two functions. Tell us about them.
Well, it's really interesting because there's so much that people don't know about dreams. And so I went to the Stanford University Center for Sleep Science and Medicine, and I've actually interviewed a couple of experts there across the years. And there's so many things that they just don't have the time or funding to study. And there's a lot of conflicting opinions, right? But what they do think, what science does seem to agree on, is that dreams have two functions. And the first one is that, okay, so your brain doesn't go to sleep completely all at once. So you're sort of awake. So that's one thing to just bear in mind. But the one function of dreams is that it relaxes basically your lizard brain, like the lowest, dumbest part of your brain from before you were standing upright. Mm-hmm. You probably experienced this, but when that happens, you're kind of paralyzed. Like, if you ever tried to scream in the middle of a dream, a nightmare, you can't, because that lower part of your brain that just helps movement, yep, is essentially paralyzed.
Yep.
But the second part is what's really interesting. The other function of the dream that scientists agree on is that what happens is it kicks your like executive function, the cortex, the smart part of your brain. It kicks it into overdrive. So you're doing all these crazy imaginative thinking that your logical brain would never do while you were awake, which is why they say you can maybe wake up and solve a puzzle, or because your brain really is actually working. It's like in overdrive while you're sleeping. Also, we didn't talk about it in this piece, but your brain is flooded while you sleep with extra chemicals. And so you're literally washing your brain. It's like getting washed, wake up, refresh. All those terms that we use, they're kind of logical because you're cleansing yourself.
You're cleansing it. You know, it's interesting. You have here a quote from Dr. Emmanuel Migno, and he's the director of Stanford University Center for Sleep Sciences and Medicine. And he said this: dreaming fires your brain in random ways, forcing it to create unexpected connections that you wouldn't logically make while you're awake. This is a part of what makes humans smarter and more creative than other species. So you're basically saying those dogs that we were talking about last week that lick us, this isn't happening cognitively while they're sleeping, or to giraffes or to zebras.
Well, it can happen, actually. He had some examples of like lemurs that showed it looked like they were dreaming, and there are some. So initially I'd had mammals in there, and he had me change it to species because he said there are some animals that do show similar behavior. So again, a lot of science, and there's not a lot of funding for studying dogs' dreams, I'm afraid.
Right, it's not a big ticket item. You also wrote about,
no,
you wrote about something I didn't know. What types of people generally remember their dreams, Heidi, and which don't?
So this is super fascinating because some people love to recall their dreams and tell you all about them. If you have a spouse, surely you've heard them. But the reason why you remember your dream is because you woke up frequently during your sleep. So you had fitful sleep. And so you're kind of, as you go deep down into sleep and you go into that dream state, well, if you come up out of it, you'll remember it. And you can remember it super vividly, right? As if it was real. Sometimes it takes you a few seconds to realize you're not being attacked by an octopus. But so those who remember their sleep, they have this fragment, what they call fragmented dream state. So you're flitting in and out of REM sleep and lighter sleep, and it's not the best kind of sleep.
Right.
So those of you that don't remember that, think that you're quote-unquote not dreaming. You're dreaming. You're just in a nice, deep sleep. You're having a nice, refreshing sleep.
Yeah, and my wife hates me because I do dig into these deep REM cycles, and she can almost never really get there. She's always worried about the next burglary, that something could happen to her daughter. And I think this is, I don't know if this is true of all men and women, but nothing can stop me from my deep sleeps, and I love them, and she doesn't get them, and I feel for her sometimes. Let's talk about the connection.
It's kind of amazing, right? You can have kind of crazy, fantastical experiences almost, or lifelike.
It's unbelievable. I have a whole ulterior life, and I can't wait to go to sleep and get some more. And my wife,
yeah,
just doesn't get that. And I think once our little girl's 18, Heidi, I think she might be able to sleep fully again. But until then, there's something maternal is kicking in. We'll see. Let's talk now about the big burning question. We've got the dreams covered, Heidi. You pose in your column, does spicy food cause bad dreams? So what did you find out?
So, okay, if you're talking about the people that remember their dreams more are the people that sleep fitfully, spicy food can elevate your core body temperature. And so if that's being, so your body cools down while you're sleeping, right? Because you're kind of shutting down some of your system. And so if your core temperature is being raised even a teensy bit by that super hot atomic pepper, then you have potential to pop out of that deep sleep. And so then you might more vividly remember your dreams. It doesn't mean that you're dreaming more vividly or that you're having more nightmares. It just means that it feels like it has the same impact because you're remembering them more. You're in and out of sleep because of that heat differential.
Right.
And also maybe digestive issues.
I think that could be it too. I mean, I was about to say it. And tell me this though, so spicy foods might keep you out of that deep sleep. What are some foods that might put you into it?
So there are, you know, everybody knows this from Thanksgiving, but there are certain foods, there are chemicals that are in foods that can trigger really great deep sleep. And tryptophan is the one that's often mentioned. It's in turkey. You know, we eat dinner on Thanksgiving at 4 p.m. I guess it's because everyone falls asleep by 8. Those are also, what's interesting is like milk and honey and turkey. There's things that you think about, kind of bedtime foods or dinner foods. And they have, some of them have these amino acids in them that are actually the precursor. So it's what would then ultimately become serotonin, MDMA, other great things that make your brain, you know, feel wonderful. So these amino acids in some of these foods like turkey and honey and, you know, they can trigger great chemicals in your brain.
Yeah, my crew, by the way, we've been trying to think about foods that can make their brains wonderful. And by the way, I need it too desperately, Heidi. So send us that list, okay? Because whatever we're eating, it ain't working for us. I wanted to hit you with this. For folks who are, you know, jolting up a lot in the nighttime and disturbing their dreams, Dr. Migno, he has some advice for them, Heidi. And by the way, I know this has got to be great stuff for a cocktail party circuit. What is that advice?
So he works with a lot of narcoleptic patients, so he has a really great database of people to work with. But he has them take a food diary and just keep track of what they're eating, when they're eating it. And he said he hasn't found any one food ever. I mean, and science has sort of never found any one food across the spectrum that affects everybody in the same way because the digestive system is so complex. But he said the really biggest thing that he has seen is large meals. Eating a large meal before you go to bed, that's going to alter your sleep cycle and you're going to maybe have a nightmare or maybe you'll feel like you're having a crazy dream and you'll wake up from it. So big, lots of food before you go to bed. So maybe there's that European style of dining that we should adhere to, you know,
yes.
Eating a larger lunch and a smaller dinner.
Yes.
You can have more restful sleep.
Well, I love it. I love it, Heidi. The burning question, does spicy food cause bad dreams? The Wall Street Journal's Heidi Mitchell. Heidi, great as always having you on.
Thanks for having me.
You bet. This is Lee Habib. This is Our American Stories.
Are these peppers for consuming?
I wouldn't. They're very hot.
I'm going to give it a try. Hot.
You're very brave.
Please, that was one of the tiny ones. This is how you eat it.
Don't do that, Tom.
Nobody to blame but me. I got nobody to blame but me. I know right away I went wrong.
This is Lee Habib, and this is Our American Stories. And now it's time for our weekly Marriage on the Mind segment with our marriage coach, Deb Wolniak, the executive director of Great Marriages for Sheboygan County in Sheboygan, Wisconsin. This week, Deb brings us her conversation with Gil and Brenda Stewart, a married couple who both come from earlier divorces and now have a ministry to help folks just like them.
My first marriage was 19 years, 3 boys. Never thought in a million years I'd be in this position. So when my first husband decided to leave, I was kind of in regrouping mode. And then going back to school, and then Gil showed up.
Yeah, I showed up. I was actually on tour with the circus, and we were having fun. And the circus kicked me out.
No, you're totally joking.
Yes,
right?
I am. I am. Because actually, the last 4 years of my marriage, which was 24 years, the last 4 years were a circus.
Mm.
Sadly to say. I mean, there were a lot of really good years, but those last 4 years were a circus. Mm. It was really sad in how that all ended. We had four children. Points in my life had been in the ministry. At that point in time, I was in the insurance business. I still am. But at that time, you know, when we went through the divorce, it was a train wreck.
Mm-hmm.
And a really sad time for mm-hmm. the entire family.
Mm-hmm.
So that's kind of where I came from.
Mm-hmm. And having gone through that, I'm sure you can empathize with a lot of couples that may have had divorce in their background.
You know, even though the demise took place while we were in church, it doesn't mean that you're insulated. I remember one guy coming to my office at the time saying, "Did you think you were bulletproof?" And I went, "Well, yeah, I did. I mean, this isn't supposed to be happening." And fortunately, though, there was... Even though life was coming apart at the seams, you know, I was in a good place because I did have a church body and a men's group around me that kind of held me steady. I don't say this too often, but, you know, there was a particular time I was coming home from a business trip and crossing a bridge, you know, in a town in Southern Oregon. And it was like, there's no reason to live. I just wanted to stop the car and jump.
Mm.
But it was like the Holy Spirit said, "No, we got more things for you to do." We got more things. So there was definitely the lies going on in my head. But
right.
I don't know, you know, Brenda, I mean, I don't know if you had that such serious thing.
Well, I didn't have 4 years to work through it. I was kind of, my first husband pretty much said, "I'm done." And we had maybe one or two counseling sessions, and I still to this day don't know exactly in his reasoning why he left. I can think of things that I could have improved on for sure, but that's where our stories are different, is that Gil really battled for 4 years, and I was just kind of left like, I'm still like, what happened? I thought everything was fine.
Mm-hmm. So I'll tell you something that I've seen when we first brought you to Wisconsin
mm-hmm.
that was interesting. We had some very conservative church-going folks, and well-meaning, of course, mm-hmm. say, "Remarriage, wait a minute, it's supposed to be great marriages. You're supposed to keep that first marriage together." What do you say to those folks that kind of come at you with a critical spirit like that? What is that?
Oh, I see the bristles on your neck. What?
Well, only because I used to be like that. In my first time marriage, I was like, what's wrong with those remarried people? What's their problem? And now that I'm on the other side, it's like, you know what, folks? You can't just slap a Jesus label on your marriage and call it good. And no, we do not endorse, condone divorce. Absolutely not. We say you're married once. That is God's perfect plan. We are not supposed to mess with that. But people mess with it because of sin. So it's like, okay, so Gil and I both were abandoned. So what are we supposed to do now? So with our marriage now and with remarriages, we want them to succeed. Why should we want them to go through a re-divorce? Because at this point, it's not about the couple, it's about the kids. So it's like, come on, church, wake up.
I think to add to that, too, with regards to the statistics, I think it was the Pew Report in 2011 that basically said that 42% of adults in the United States now are in some form of a step-family relationship, be it a step-child themselves, a step-parent, a step-grandparent. It permeates our culture. So what would I say to somebody who says, no, don't pay attention to remarriage? I would say, I'm sorry, but you'd be missing about 40% of your congregation, which is really kind of scary. Because when you think about it, those people are already dealing with regret and shame. Mm-hmm. And where do they go?
So there's the person driving in their car at home listening to this program saying, "All right, but you don't understand. I'm already in the crazy. What am I supposed to do about that?"
Well, depending upon how far you are into the crazy, keep a couple things in mind, and we'll just banter here a little bit. If the average step family, according to statistics, basically is on an average step family may or may not blend, but typically it takes anywhere between 5 to 7 years. So if you're at about year two or three and you are really struggling, I would have to say to you, you're right on time. That is totally normal. So if you're having a difficult time, just fasten your seatbelt a little bit tighter, lean into your spouse a little bit closer, and just can't say it any other way, but sometimes you just have to gut it out and to love one another, even though it's really rocky.
58% of people have not dealt with their past pain when they've remarried. 58%. So that to me is like, okay, what do I need to look at in my life of unforgiveness or hurt or unmet expectations or anything like that? What can I do to have my heart full again, to be fully able to give it to my spouse,
right,
and to be able to have that high level of trust and honesty, and that you feel safe that anything I share with you, you won't use against me. And when trust has been obliterated in previous relationships, that may take some time to build, but that's okay, because it's amazing when you do that vulnerability stuff, how much strength that brings to the couple.
Well, and I think too, the crazy, because, well, what's driving the crazy? Is it the relationship? Typically in remarried couples, the crazy isn't driven by the couple. Typically the couple's getting along okay. It's those people, i.e. your children. And most of the time, the marriages that are second marriages have more difficulty because of the dynamics of kids. Well, sure, even in a nuclear one first time family, kids can know, they know how to drive a wedge. Multiply that by about a zillion with stepchildren. If that's what's causing the crazy, then, you know, there's the nature of setting some healthy boundaries. And maybe the reason why that kid is flipping out is that they didn't get a place, a healthy place to grieve. Mm-hmm. They may be grieving and it's coming out all over the place. And that might be what's driving the crazy. And unfortunately, Deb, we don't grieve real well in the United States. We don't give a place for it. We're just supposed to be shiny face and move on. What a bunch of posers. Honestly, we really need to learn how to let a healthy level of grief take place. And honestly, the most loving thing you could do is just put your arms around the crazy and hold it tight till it settles down.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
It's good.
You're helped in a safe place to land,
yeah, mm-hmm,
and that you're not going to go away.
That's huge. I mean, honestly, for Brenda and I as a step family couple, one of the most soothing things I can hear from my now wife is to say, I'm freaking out. And for her to say, I'm not going anywhere. I'm here. I'm not going to abandon you. I'm not this. I'm not going anywhere. And I can say, oh, wow, I trust you.
Mm-hmm.
That's got as much weight to it as I love you,
mm-hmm,
for us.
Yeah, absolutely.
That makes sense.
I think our kids need to hear that too, because our remarriage represents another loss to them. Because, I mean, I'm in my 50s and I still want my parents to get back together who were divorced 40 years ago. So it's just that innate, that's the right way things are supposed to be in relationships. So even though we might be thrilled and happy about the remarriage, don't assume that our kids are, or other family members, because it's not just about the family tree. It's the step family forest now, because you have aunts and uncles, in-laws, ex-laws, outlaws, that who knows where that, and if they've even grieved the loss of the family.
Well, you heard from Gil and Brenda Stewart. When we come back in our Marriage on the Mind segment, our marriage coach, Deb Wolniak. More after this. This is Lee Habib, and this is Our American Stories. We're back with our weekly Marriage on the Mind segment with our marriage coach, Deb Wolniak. Deb is the executive director of Great Marriages for Sheboygan County in Sheboygan, Wisconsin, a group whose innovative couple-to-couple mentoring program has an 87% success rate in saving struggling marriages, and that's compared to a mere 28 with traditional counseling. Every week, Deb joins us for storytelling about marriage, marriage of every kind, old marriages, new marriages, troubled marriages, and here, second marriages. And that fascinating conversation with Gil and Brenda Stewart, Deb brought to us with Alex's help. And Deb, Gil and Brenda Stewart now have a ministry called Restored and Remarried to help folks just like them. How did you meet this couple, Deb?
Well, I met them through a group called NARMI, the National Association for Relationship and Marriage Education, a wonderful group that meets even once a year. This year, their conference is out in Anaheim, California, July 16th through 21st. If you want to check out their website, it's NARME.org, N-A-R-M-E.org, and you can find out more about that. But let me tell you, the people that gather at this particular summit are wonderful educators and program folks that are throughout the country that help support family and marriage. And these people are some of the best of the best. I met Gil and Brenda a couple years ago down in Atlanta, and I was amazed at the gifting that they have. Actually, I take that back. It was Texas. I got to think about the right conference. And they, right away, I saw them across the room, and I said, the lights are on in their head. I need to go talk to them. There was something about how they acted with each other, their body language, their conversational tone. I'm like, there's a story behind that. Instantly fell in love with their story and with the work that they do with both faith-based and non-faith-based folks. I want to make that clear.
Yep.
And I said, you know, we got to get you to Wisconsin. We got to keep learning because the experiences you had are teaching so many people.
You know, I found the whole discussion about the church to be fascinating. Look, some of our listeners go to church, some don't. But for the ones that do, we somehow feel inoculated, as the couple said, from this thing called divorce, as if somehow this seal of Christianity is some kind of good housekeeping seal. We can't get in trouble. And of course we can.
Right.
And talk about that, because there are human beings inside this church. And these things are happening more and more. Are churches dealing with this well? Deborah, are they in denial?
Yeah, I think there's going to be two sides to this particular story. The first thing is people do need to be aware of, in the church of their choice, that couples are struggling. Families are struggling. They may show their, you know, Sunday face and things are good. You might even have a climate in your church where you kind of, quote unquote, play the game and church it. You know what I mean? But that's not ultimately, for those of you who are of faith, where God, capital G, calls us. He calls us to a more vulnerable position to say, listen, I want to work with you through these challenges. So a really good church is going to give opportunities for their congregation, individually, in private, or in groups for awareness. What are some of the challenges we're having in our marriage today? What are some of the things, where are we at? Because every marriage looks different. It's almost like a fingerprint. It's very specific to you as a couple.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the biggest challenges I'm going to give you guys as a couple, if you're listening, is really identify where you're at. What's working in your marriage and what are the challenge areas, especially those of you who have been remarried, because your divorce rate is even up into the 70s if you don't take care of it. 70% or 73 in some cases of second marriages get divorced. We don't want that. We want you to be, in fact, that might even be a little high. It may be as low as 63. It just depends on what area of the country you're in. But it really needs to be addressed, honestly, within your relationship and in the church. To be able to go to a pastor that can coach you, that has experience in that area, is important. If they don't have that, please seek out somebody in your community who does. Ask around and find out who has worked with couples on remarriage issues or on marriage issues that has a proven track record to help you out.
Well, and those remarriage issues are of a different order than the marriage issues in some respects, Deb, and that is these kids and the reblending of families. And I've seen this in my own life. And that we finally get to hear somebody say, look, it's 2 years. Don't worry about it. Hug that kid. Get through it. Let them know it's okay. Talk about this whole reblending issue and how this exacerbates or makes more difficult that marriage possibility in the long shot of succeeding. Talk about the blending of these two separate families, Deb.
Right. So I think Gil and Brenda did a really good job on identifying what is your core story from your first relationship. As you come into that second relationship, that second marriage, it's not only working out the challenges within your couple relationship, but really bringing along the kids. And the kids, you know, they're going to show different sides of their emotions. Sometimes before you're married, things are awesome. I mean, they're looking forward to the wedding, you know, things are rolling along. And then all of a sudden, once the ring goes on the finger, some of the kids start to either change their emotional response to that. And part of that may be, and it depends on each child because they're all different, it might be that they're seeing now that they have a safe place to start working through some of that emotions, or maybe not feeling safe. You need to help identify at an age-appropriate manner with that child, what are you feeling? Maybe getting that one-on-one time with the parent of origin that you can, like, sit down with that child and say, what are the things that you're seeing? What do you like? What are things that concern you? Reassuring that child, but then possibly getting additional support for that child. That could be in a counseling situation or a coaching or mentoring scenario. Sometimes, especially for teens, it may even be somebody either in your church environment or even out in an area where maybe you have a working professional that they identify with because that's the career they want to go to, that can come alongside them and really encourage them. They're going through change just like you're going through change. Sometimes the learning curve is longer because they're at a totally different stage in their lives, and what they're looking for is that you're not going to leave me. This is a secure environment. I'm building trust with a new group of family members, and that bonding experience takes time. They use a really good example. It's not a blender where you press a button and it mixes all up. It really is one of those pots that stews on the stove, that slow cooker. And we all have tasted it. When we go home and we have that beautiful smell we walk into the house with, and we can maybe dive into that tender roast beef, we know that all those flavors have kind of mixed together to make a beautiful dish. That's kind of what we're hoping for with those families that are blended, that it can create its own special blend of newness and comfort and also growth. Because guess what? As much as you're afraid to want to go through this and as much as the kids are afraid, I will tell you what, as you work through it as a family, that bond strengthens even stronger than before. And as you build that trust and respect, these kids, these young folks, are going to be sent off into the world. And they're going to say, as they make their marriage commitments, I know that what I went through was tough, but I know that I can take what I've learned and apply it to my marriage. Very important.
You bet. You know, that 5 to 7 year mark as opposed to the 2 year mark, and you know, in a country that, as your couple said, don't grieve well, or don't like to grieve, we also want fast. We want things to get resolved fast. We want to get over things fast. And I think this is it runs in opposition to how human beings actually do heal. You know, I'll tell you a quick story, Deb. I remember seeing the movie Kramer versus Kramer. And if you remember that movie, Meryl Streep just walks out. And my parents were always there. So I sort of grieved a little bit, but I was with a group of friends. And two of my friends were crying uncontrollably during that scene. And their parents had been divorced. And it was as if both of them, these young ladies had said, and it was a boy that was left behind in the movie, but these two young girls were left behind by a father who walked out. In this movie, the woman walked out and left the little boy behind. But they remember that scene. They remember that scene, and it puts them right back when they were kids. And in some respects, they told me they still weren't over it, Deb, because they never got to really talk about it with anybody.
Right.
Talk about that.
And that's too bad, because part of that is an opportunity if put in the right environment and the openness of the parent, even the parent that may have been left behind, to be able to talk through that and grieve with that child, giving them space to say what they need to say. And sometimes, again, let me note that this might have to be with a professional, because you're dealing with the hardcore issues of the human mind and the human heart.
Yep.
And when these things feel broken, it affects everything. It affects your decision making. It affects how maybe you might even choose certain jobs or other relationships. And we want each individual to be able to walk through that pain in a healthy manner. Yes, acknowledge it. Even like 40 years later, that still is grieving me. But I've learned from that in these ways to help me process that even 40 years later. Know that there's never a timeline. You can't set a clock for 5 minutes and just get over it.
Yep.
It's just not going to happen. You need to yourself be in tune with yourself to know what your needs are and to be honest and courageous to be able to say that. And to those of you who have parents that maybe are like, you know, in their 60s, 70s, 80s, and they're not at a place where they can give back in this way, and you're an adult child of divorce, I really want you to take a moment with yourself and do some journaling, because I want you to get in tune with what's going on there. Something that you're struggling with today could be highly influenced by things that maybe happened decades ago, and you've never given yourself the opportunity and the freedom to explore that. But we want to make sure that you get the right support system around you that can help coach you through that. There can be a lot of stuff there.
Well, Deb, thanks so much as always. A great segment again. We're talking with Deb Wolniak, our weekly Marriage on the Mind segment. And again, Deb, thanks for all you do.
Thank you.
This is Lee Habib. This is Our American Stories. Habib, and this is Our American Stories, and it's time for our This Day in History segment, brought to us by Hillsdale College. And there's no better place in America to learn about our nation's history, the Constitution, great literature, all the things that matter in life. And if you can't go to Hillsdale, Hillsdale will come to you with their terrific and free online courses. Check them out at hillsdale.edu. On This Day in History, Charles Chuck Colson passed away. And by the way, a hero to me and millions. A man that a lot of Americans don't know, though. But a man who is at the center of power in the White House. And he fell from power and ended up as far from the White House as you could imagine. Prison. And ended up back in the White House by the end of his life, receiving the Presidential Citizens Medal, the second highest honor in the land for a private citizen. You'll hear how and so much more about the dramatic redemption story of Charles Colson, Chuck, during our hour-long celebration of this man's life. Chuck was born in Boston in 1931, born into a classic American family with classic American values.
And I'd been raised this way. I'd been a Marine officer. I'd learned about duty and honor, and I'd learned about integrity as a Marine. And as a kid growing up in the Depression in tough economic times, my dad was going to school at night, studying to be a lawyer, and he was working days, but on the weekends he'd spend some time with me. He said, Chuck, one thing, always tell the truth and never lie. When you work as hard as you possibly can, no matter what it is. Even used the example of cleaning toilets. He said, it doesn't matter what you're doing. Do it well. Earn your pay. Do a hard day's work for an honest day's pay. Pay your bills. I mean, I was steeped in what we then knew as the Puritan work ethic. And being honest, this was a big thing with me.
So young Chuck was learning what almost every American was learning back in that day. It was a sort of a common culture. And there were people from all over different parts of Europe and all over the world. But these were pretty much the things that we all took as true. Chuck Colson started out as a young hotshot. His friend, Eric Metaxas, even described him as a wonderkind. Here's Chuck on this early time.
My early years, I was the first person in my family who would go to college. I thought if I could get to college, and I won a scholarship to Brown University. And when I got through there, it was time for me to go into the military because the Korean War was raging. And so I became a lieutenant in the Marines and rose very rapidly. I'd won honors in school. I think everything I ever did in my life, I was successful at. I went to law school nights while I was working as an assistant to a United States senator. At one point, Newsweek wrote about me as the youngest administrative assistant to a United States senator. I think I was 28. And ran campaigns, loved it, started a law firm, great success, got to know Richard Nixon. In 1968, when he was elected president, he asked me to come. I was, at that point, left a law practice, which was making a lot of money, and went into his administration
as his special counsel. I had kind of an open portfolio. I was the guy that advised him on lots of the political things. It was a very exciting thing because I arrived in his office when I was 38 years old, and my office was immediately next door to his. And so I was with him and in and out of his office every day. And that's a pretty heady business.
And heady it was. And so how did everything turn? For someone who described himself as a patriot and one who grew up with the Protestant work ethic that he described in that first clip. And by the way, you're hearing from Chuck Colson himself, and we do this all the time. We don't like to opine about people. We want you to hear about these important people's lives, the critical events in their lives from themselves, from them. So how is it that he became one of the most hated men in America? He penned the infamous memo known as Nixon's Enemies List. And he leaked information from Daniel Ellsberg's FBI file after Ellsberg stole classified documents about the Vietnam War that were known as the Pentagon Papers. Just bad stuff. And a lawyer note, no less, with an oath almost as important as the Hippocratic Oath. Lawyers themselves, we don't do this stuff. Here's Chuck Colson describing what was wrong with Chuck Colson.
When President Nixon asked me to leave my law firm in Washington and come in and be his special counsel, the first thing I did was to be certain there'd be no conflicts of interest. I took everything I'd earned as a lawyer, I put it in a blind trust, I told my law partners not to come visit me, and they didn't. I was certain that I would never be compromised. I was determined not to be. I would get gifts at Christmas time, for example, and I would take them down to the White House switchboard operators, the guys that drove my cars, because I was never going to be compromised. And I was so determined, I ended up going to prison. Why? I think you can be so self-righteous that you don't see what's really going on. You become oblivious to your own insensitivities because you're sure nobody can compromise you. Human beings have the infinite capacity of self-rationalization, and that's exactly what I did. I was in a lot of meetings where there were high stakes, where the President of the United States would say, national security depends on this. Kissinger came in fulminating one day over some documents that had been stolen, and he said, this is going to compromise all of national security. I can think back on times, I remember when the President, four or five of us in the office, and the President was exploding over something that had gotten out and was in the hands of the Brookings Institution, and he turned to Bob Holden. He said, Bob, have we got a team in place that can go in and get those documents back? Remember, I've asked you for that. Then I later realized that was a time when I should have stopped and said, wait a minute, Mr. President, think about the consequences of this. But I did not. Self-righteousness is believing you're so good that you couldn't be compromised. And that's the kind of pride that's fatal and was in my life because I was so sure of myself that I didn't realize how vulnerable I was, as every human being is.
What a confession, and anybody who's listening to that and doesn't hear a part of themselves at some point in their life is just full of it. And that's why people love Chuck Colson. He didn't whitewash his own complicity. In fact, he put himself right in the center of it. And pride, my friends, we all know pride is the great killer. This is Lee Habib. This is Our American Stories. The story of Chuck Colson. You're not going to believe it. Hold on. There's so much more good stuff to come. This is Lee Habib, and this is Our American Stories. And the team here just assembled one heck of a story you're about to hear. We just heard from Colson, his rise to power from obscurity, from just an ordinary American background, right to the White House, and then the fall. And Colson had left the White House in 1972 after leading Nixon's successful re-election and entered private practice, but the Watergate scandal where Nixon operatives had broken into the Democrat headquarters was just starting to percolate. The FBI and others were seeking indictments, and Colson was a main target. In the midst of all this, he went to see an old friend, Tom Phillips, the CEO at the time of Raytheon. An old friend who seemed like a totally new person.
I walked in his office one day and still feeling kind of empty. And I looked at him and he was a completely different guy. He was a guy like myself who'd worked his way up the hard way, self-made man, became head CEO of this corporation when he was barely 40 years old. Dynamic guy. And he was at peace and he started asking me about my family. And finally I said to him, Tom, you've changed since I saw you 4 years ago. He said, yes, I have, Chuck. And then he looked up at the clock and he didn't look me straight in the eye, but he said, I have accepted Jesus Christ and committed my life to him. Now, I got to tell you, good people, I took a firm grip on the bottom of my chair. I'd never heard anyone talk like that. I grew up in that vast Unitarian wasteland of New England. I never heard the gospel. I never heard anybody talk about Christ as a person. I'd gone to Sunday school and learned all the lessons you learn in Sunday school, but it didn't mean anything to me. He looked away, as I later found out, because he'd never done this with anyone before. Kind of interesting. I thought about that for the next 3 months, and I couldn't get it out of my mind. And so I went back to him one evening in August of 1973, and I said, Tom, you've got to explain this to me. And he said, before I do, I want to read you a chapter from a book, a chapter I'd recommend for all of you, particularly because you're type A high achievers. You wouldn't be at Columbia or otherwise. And he read to me the chapter from C.S. Lewis's Mere Christianity entitled The Great Vice, The Great Sin, Pride. Proud man is always looking through life, looking down on other people and things, and therefore can't see something above himself, immeasurably superior, God. I listened to this chapter, and C.S. Lewis, if you know him, the Oxford Dean, who was a great Christian apologist, as well as a great professor of medieval literature, I listened to that and I realized he's writing about me. I thought I'd done all these good things because I wanted to serve my country and I wanted to be a success at my profession, and it was really all about me. And I sat there that night in pain listening to that chapter read. And then Tom told me how he'd gone forward at a crusade here in New York with Billy Graham preaching and given his life to Christ. And I was really moved. He wanted to pray with me, and I said, no, I'd never prayed except in a church. So he prayed. But that night he told me of his own experience when he gave his life to Christ. And here I was, the tough guy, and I don't think I'd ever cried or I'd let anyone know if I did. I left his home that night. I looked back, and I got into the automobile, and I tried to drive away, but I could not, because the tough guy was crying too hard. I couldn't see the road in front of me. Hmm. I pulled over and sat there. I have no idea for how long, at least an hour, maybe longer, thinking about my life, thinking about could there be a God, and if there were, could I know him? And I just called out to him. I didn't know any of the words. I'd never seen any brochures about evangelicalism. I never knew there was such a thing. I knew nothing about organized Christianity, except I'd once in a while been dragged to church as a kid. But that night, for the first time in my life, I was sure there was a God. And I was sure he was hearing me. I woke up the next morning figuring I was going to be embarrassed, and instead I couldn't wait to get my hands on Mere Christianity and read it from cover to cover.
And I can only tell you that book did it for me too. 42 years without God and same chapter. And that's why I almost wasn't going to be able to speak after that. I had not heard that clip before. And if you are struggling with pride, pick up Mere Christianity. It'll whack you over the side of the head. So he had taken that first step in his Christian walk, but it was a lonely first step. As author Eric Metaxas, who wrote the great book Bonhoeffer, tells us.
He became a Christian. The press couldn't believe that this hard-nosed, they called him the White House hatchet man, do anything to get the president elected, sort of dirty politics. That this guy became a Christian, nobody would believe it. He became a Christian, and because I knew him personally, I can tell you this man was the real deal.
Well, a lot of people were wondering whether this was just a fake conversion, and people were doubting Colson's story. Former Attorney General John Mitchell even snapped, quote, I'll take my chances with the Lions over believing Colson. But others in Capitol Hill Prayer Group had softer hearts. Let's take a listen.
And he talked about his conversion, which we pressed him on. But then he said, what worries me that if it is not for real, what will that do to Jesus Christ? And then one of the persons who was there, Senator Harold Hughes, probably the most liberal Democratic senator, how liberal he was is that many times in conference, whenever a Republican would speak, he'd walk out. And he said, Chuck, if you've accepted Jesus Christ into your life, and I believe you have, he stood up and walked towards Chuck, and with his arms reached out, said, I am your brother for life. And Chuck rose, and they embraced each other.
Well, for someone that viewed themselves as a patriot, the impact of the events of the Watergate scandal were becoming particularly close and trying for Chuck Colson.
And to suddenly be told Charles Colson, the United States government, against Charles Colson, was a shattering moment. I look back on it now, however, and I am grateful because that was part of God convicting me of my own past and my own sins, and giving me a new life in Christ.
And that's a remarkable clip. He was grateful. He was grateful that he was going to have to pay his dues, and he was grateful that he was humbled. And without that conviction, who knows what would have happened to Chuck Colson? And look at all the things that would not have happened. Well, this is something for all of us to remember in our own trying times, to remember that there's a purpose in them. It's happening for a reason. Hard to understand when it's happening. It's happened to all of us. It's happening to many of you right now. You're wondering, why is this happening to me? Yet his lawyers encouraged him to stray from this new person he had become. Boy, those lawyers will always get you in a jam with yourself. Here's Eric Metaxas again.
His lawyer, he had a pretty good lawyer, says, guess what, Chuck, I got you a plea bargain. You're not going to have to go to jail. All you have to do is say you did something you didn't do, but don't worry about it. You just, you know, play the game and you won't go to jail. Well, Chuck, because he'd become a Christian and because he actually took it seriously, said, yeah, I can't do that. I'm not going to lie. If I have to go to jail, I'll go to jail. His lawyer, and I tell this in the book, went crazy. He said, you don't understand. No one does this. You take the plea. Shut up and take the plea bargain. Chuck refused.
Chuck refused. Again, the new man has to do things differently. And not what the lawyers say. Not what the lawyers say. Colson knew he didn't have any culpability with the Watergate scandal, but he also knew in his soul he wasn't guilt-free. And his faith wouldn't let him walk away from that fact.
I got back to Washington and I realized I was guilty of some of these things. And then I started being called before the prosecutors and I testified 44 times under oath. And one day I realized I got to put an end to this. And so I took the one thing, actually I took something I hadn't been charged with and walked into the prosecutors one day and I said, no deals, no bargains. This is something I did. I'll plead guilty. I want to get it behind me.
And when we come back, well, you're going to hear even more of this riveting story because Chuck Colson was going to face prison time and far away from home in Alabama of all places. And so again, imagine this. The apple of everyone's eye, successful all the way to the top, gives up a lucrative law practice, ends up at the seat of power, the White House itself. And when bad stuff started happening, the guy who's supposed to be the White House lawyer doesn't speak up. You bet he was guilty. Any lawyer will tell you he was guilty. What Chuck Colson does with the rest of his life, you're not going to believe it. It's so beautiful. More about this life, this remarkable life, after these messages. This is Lee Habib, and this is Our American Stories. And we honor all kinds of folks here on this show, all kinds of people. This Day in History has featured Levi Strauss's life, John Wooden's life, Johnny Cash's. We just did Merle Haggard because we had to. Born and died on the same day. Andy Grove. Old, new, business, sports, doesn't matter. So many amazing people. And people of faith, too. Reverend Martin Luther King. We did not call him doctor the whole hour. We refused to. We played some of his great speeches and showed how the media sort of secularizes this incredible man of faith. And so we spent some time on faith, too, and some of the remarkable things that people of faith have done and what faith has done for them. And my goodness, what a religious conversion did to this man. Well, you're not going to believe it, because now we're going to dig into the story. So you just heard that this guy just couldn't walk away. And he could have. He could have just accepted the plea bargain and avoided jail time. And which one of us wouldn't do that? Can you imagine coming back to your wife and saying, look, honey, I know I could get out of this, but I really got to do some time. Because you see, my walk with God requires it. What he had actually done, by the way, was obstructing the Daniel Ellsberg investigation by leaking information from his FBI file. He would now spend 7 months in prison, a time and a place that gave Chuck a perspective on life that he couldn't find over the 40 years he was a free man.
And yet the most amazing thing in that prison, I'd see these men and my heart ached for them because they were lying on their bunks staring into the nothingness, nothing to do, and their bodies atrophying and their souls corroding. Just that slow death. That's the horrible thing about doing time, as we inmates say. But I grew to love those guys. I was reading a little Bible study and had a passage in Hebrews which said God became lower than the angels for a period of time that he would not be ashamed to call us his brothers. I looked around at all these guys, drug dealers and murderers and bank robbers and all kinds of people, and I thought to myself, I'm no better than they are. I really got to love them. We got a little Bible study at night. There were seven of us. There were three convicted dope thieves, a swindler, a car thief, a moonshiner, and former special counsel to the President of the United States. We'd be on our knees praying, and I really had a great relationship. I discovered in prison, away from all that power, the trappings of power, away from all the distractions in our culture, when you come face to face with yourself and God, that you find that which eludes you through life when you're seeking all the things of the world.
What a powerful testimony. And you know, when we were doing Johnny Cash's life, we found the same thing out. That Cash didn't see himself as being better than those guys he was singing to in the prison. And I think Bono had the greatest words you could ever say to a man when he was there to eulogize Johnny Cash. He said, Johnny Cash doesn't sing to the damned, he sings with the damned. So, Coulson served his time, and then he decided to serve his calling, a calling that he found while serving his time.
Then the question comes, why do I go into prisons? A lot of people ask me that. I've been asked that for the last 33 years since I started going in. They say, why are you going into prisons? And somebody wanted me to work with, I'd known most of the politicians and knew a lot of the world leaders in politics. And so people said to me, why don't you work in the ministry among leaders of governments? I said, because God's called me to the prisons. Why? Because they're neglected. And why do I care about that? Because I firmly believe, as the answer to the first question you ask about where we came from, that we were created by God in his image. The imago Dei, the image of God, is in every single human being, regardless of color, stage of his life, degree of dependency, regardless of his country of origin. The image of God is in every single person. And so I go into those prisons to this day loving those men because they're God's image bearers.
Indeed. Coulson formed the Prison Fellowship Ministry and started an in-depth look at how both conservatives and liberals look at incarceration, and then, of course, what the Bible says about it all.
And the conservative says each person getting his due is when he steps out of line, which is what the caseworker said to me when I arrived in prison. He said, Coulson, you're here for one reason. punishment. Not bad. He was right. So the conservative view is retribution. And the liberal view is distribution, so that each person gets his due. Interesting thing about the biblical worldview of justice. Biblical view of justice, if you read the Old Testament, contains book after book after book of social justice. It also respects private property. It also talks about punishing people when they do wrong. Interestingly enough, not with prisons in the Old Testament or the New Testament. That's a relatively modern invention. But with a form of punishment as retribution. So the interesting thing is that the biblical worldview embraces both, which we argue about. All the great arguments in America about justice are between the distributive or the retributive models. The Bible embraces both in balance. The only one that is filled with grace and seeks restoration is the Christian view of justice.
Indeed. Indeed. And let's see how Coulson actually put this biblical approach towards incarceration into practice.
I saw the toughest inmate who was in the Washington State prison system. He'd been known in California as the most incorrigible inmate in the state of California. I met him when I was in the Walla Walla prison in the state of Washington when it was about to erupt in a riot because the inmates were rioting over the fact they'd been locked in their cells for 9 months because 10 guards had been murdered over a 12-month period. It was the most brutal place I've been in my life. And I came into a room just much like this, only in a prison, and about the same number of people, a few hundred scattered around the room. No guards came in. One guard came in, but he took his jacket off, so he wasn't on duty. And I talked to these guys about what had happened to me in prison. I talked to them about what Christ could mean to them. And the big guy sitting down front, the toughest of the tough, looked at me, and he came up to me afterwards, and he said, "I think you're for real." He slammed me on the back. I was glad he thought I was for real. And he said, "Would you come in here and help us?" And so we did. We started going in that prison. He was converted. His name was Don Dennis. He was converted when he was released from prison. He came with us, and he spent 10 years before he died working with kids on the streets of Dallas, Texas. That's purpose. That's something worth getting up for in the morning. That gives us a reason for living, because something, somehow, some way, each day, I might be able to advance the kingdom and serve Christ's calling.
And that's it. I wanted to read a bit from Eric Metaxas on Coulson's conversion and all the conversions he worked on the rest of his life. Quote, "In the following week, as he and his wife Patty enjoyed their time on the Maine coast, Chuck went to work. He had brought along C.S. Lewis's Mere Christianity and a raft of yellow legal pads. In his sometimes comically thorough and deliberate way, Chuck made notes and followed the arguments like the brilliant lawyer that he was. He wasn't about to accept something without thinking it through. At first, the idea that he had to accept not just God but Jesus was confusing. How could he logically accept a 2,000-year-old historical figure from Palestine as the God of the universe? It seemed absurd. Then he read the famous passage in Lewis's book where Lewis lays out the three alternatives in no uncertain terms, saying that Jesus is either Lord, liar, or lunatic. The alternative not open to us is to think of Jesus merely as a powerful moral teacher. It was clear and it was discomforting. Chuck knew that in his encounter with the mind of C.S. Lewis, he had met his match. The man's logic was irrefutable. It was my choice, as simple, stark, and frightening as that," Chuck later recalled. "No fine shadings, no gradations, no compromises. No one had ever thrust this truth at me in such a direct and unsettling way." This is Lee Habib, the words of Chuck Coulson, Mere Christianity, and then him bringing this same logic and faith to men in trouble in prisons across this great country. More after this. This is Our American Stories.
Mm-hmm.
This is Lee Habib, and this is Our American Stories, the life of Chuck Colson, and what a life it was. And not often enough in our general secular media do we hear great stories like this about people of faith. And that's why we do it. And let's hear about the impact of Chuck's work directly from a former prisoner.
Though they don't give you a Bible in school, Chuck made sure you had one in jail. And I am very grateful for that, because that's where God revealed himself to me too, through the printed page of sacred scripture in a roach-infested jail 26 years ago. And not only that, but he sent volunteers into these many prisons. He didn't just hit one. He hit all of them across the board, around the globe. And he discipled and mentored and helped inmates grow. He said in one of his newsletters a long time ago, he said, "I want to help inmates learn to use their time and not let time use them." He not only taught that, he believed it. He used his time.
I want to let and teach the inmates how to use their time and not let time use them. My goodness, that's something we could all apply to our own lives. So powerful. Here's another prisoner who was forever changed by those Bibles Chuck was handing out, despite him originally using that Bible for, let's just say, a less noble purpose.
His name is Rick Vasquez, Hispanic. And in that cell, he had a Bible, but he used the Bible to tear the pages out and roll them for cigarettes. And one day before he started rolling the pages, he read some parts of it. And as he read it, he cried out to God. He said, "God, save me. I want to know you. I want to be free. I want to be yours." And that man was converted, and that man was discipled by our people who work in that prison. That man had 2 more years in prison. He led half the gang members to Christ. Changed the prison he was in. Then we got him in one of our prisons where he worked for another year, and now he's out of prison, pastor of a Hispanic church in Houston, bringing in 10 or 12 ex-offenders out of the prisons every month into his church. That's hard to argue with. When you see that over and over and over again, that's empirical evidence that something does happen to those persons to convert them from one lifestyle to another and to live a different way. And it is the only answer we've found in crime.
It is the only answer so far. By the way, it just drives, I think, many government leftist types crazy. And not all, but I think the bureaucrats particularly. Because this is a really private solution and a spiritual solution to something government just can't fix. Now let's look at the big picture. What kind of scale we're actually talking about here.
Street today that runs 10 prisons in America as Christian prisons, as models, getting a phenomenal recidivism rate, phenomenal success. We have 50,000 volunteers around America, and the ministry has spread to 113 countries of the world. And every Christmas we deliver gifts to children whose parents are imprisoned. 500,000 kids a year. We've been doing this since 1982. Incredible things happening, none of which I planned. You got to believe me. I'm a pretty good strategist. I knew how to plan things. I didn't plan this. I thought, okay, God, if you want to take me and use me in the prisons, you take me and use me in the prisons. And he did far more with my life out of my brokenness and out of my weakness than I'd ever been able to do with my life out of my own power and influence and ability.
He didn't plan it. And he said, "I'm a heck of a strategist, but I could have never planned this." And that is so true. It's so true in so many of our lives. Chuck had inspired others to serve their calling, joining in his ministry. Again, 50,000 volunteers. That's just crazy. Let's hear from one person who's calling Christ working through Chuck had inspired a billionaire we spoke with earlier this week named B. Wayne Hughes Jr., a guy who was trying to give back to our country by wading into the world of politics until one day everything was changed because he met Chuck.
I met Chuck Colson along the way. And I like to say that, you know, Chuck vaccinated me when I wasn't looking because he probably outside of my dad is the one person that's made the biggest impact in my life. And Chuck basically told me something that I'll never forget. He said, politics is nothing but a reflection of culture. If you don't like the politics, look at the culture. If you want to make a difference, you're not going to make it in politics. You're going to make it fighting into the culture wars. And at that point, I was looking for significance in my life. I'd made the money. I was looking to go ahead and help my country. I mean, anybody can see that we're in a world of hurt, and things have only gotten worse since then. But I saw what Chuck was doing, and I realized that what I was looking for was not going to be found in the mirror. It was going to be focusing my gaze on the other.
And we talked to B. Wayne Hughes, Jr., and you can go to our website at ouramericannetwork.org. Now, B. Wayne Hughes, Jr. had never been in prison, but he was addicted to something else, and it was work. And his pride had put his work before his family. He lost his wife, and he lost things that were precious to him. And that's what led him to the Lord, and then ultimately to Chuck Colson. So go figure. So here's this billionaire dedicating his resources and time to doing the same thing and the same kind of work Chuck Colson does. In fact, we talked to one of those prisoners the other night, David Ray, who's a part of that program inspired by Chuck Colson. And David had killed a person when he was 17 or 18 years old. And we talked to him, frankly, last night about all kinds of things. And I got to tell you, it was breathtaking. And the crew here listening we were just blown away. It's the kind of radio you're not going to hear almost anywhere in this country. And we're proud to bring you stories like this. Wayne has since brought a theology program called the Urban Ministry Institute into 22 California prisons, a program whose graduates boast a 2.85 recidivism rate compared to 54% for California prisoners overall. To close out our hour-long celebration of Chuck Colson's life, we'll hear from one of the folks who knew him the best, eulogizing him.
My name is Emily Colson, and I am very blessed to be Chuck Colson's daughter. Today we celebrate a life well lived. I am thankful to be old enough to have known my father before he became a Christian, and to see the change, the transformation in my father when Christ ruled in his heart. My father still had the same intellect and drive and passion for life, but a softness came over him. I think about my dad's office in his home in Florida, the desk, highly polished, where he worked tirelessly. And I think about the overstuffed green chair in the corner, where every morning he would kneel and pray. I think of the 3x5 cards my dad carried in his pocket underneath his jacket. There were 15 or 20 of them there, an ever-growing to-do list. But in that list, he also had names, people that he prayed for every day. My dad became, as Scripture says, a new creation, and he loved his family differently.
Colson ended up receiving 15 honorary doctorates, and in 1993 he was awarded the Templeton Prize for Progress in Religion, the world's largest annual award, $1 million. And it was in the field of religion, given to a person who has, quote, made an exceptional contribution to affirming life's spiritual dimension. Of course, in true keeping with Chuck Colson's mission, he donated this prize to further the work of Prison Fellowship, as he did all of his speaking fees and his royalties. What a life lived. The life of Chuck Colson. Here on Our American Stories, a life beautifully lived.
Thank you. how sweet the sound that saved a wretch like me. I once was lost, but now am found. Was blind, but now I see.